Blog Talk Radio.
Big spoke in the wheel of the year just toward the lengthening of days. So now we tilt toward the sun a little bit more, halfway toward spring from when we left the season of summer there over in the fall, and now we're halfway into that. And then, of course, next coming into February, we start moving into our seedling time. So looking toward another growing season, and, of course, still plenty of time to be planting more things over winter, even sprouting things indoors and enjoying more greens and various things that help keep us healthy and happy throughout this cold and holiday time of year. Unseasonably warm in many areas. And of course, in the last few years, we've had the whole USDA plant hardiness map shift temperature zones north. We've had things warming up, and new interactive maps are showing how we've got a little bit different growing maps happening out there. But it's always a process of adaptation these days, adapting to what's going on. Sometimes, though, there is no adaptation. When it comes to extreme weather events and extreme climate change that's happening in certain areas, and I'm not saying it's all natural, right? We've got plenty of geoengineering going on. We've got plenty of forests being chopped and things being destabilized in many different ways that are converging. And in some cases, there's just outright destruction. And that loss of life, like just absolute lakes drying up. I've been rather amazed to find out about some of the ecosystems out there and what's going on as far as the massive changes that have happened and how things are just a different world. And one of them is there in South America, a very, very big lake, Lake Poopó. Yes, Lake Poopó there is completely dried up. And it's not a little pond. It's not a little puddle-jumping pond there. It is the second largest lake in Bolivia. It's just about disappeared. And this has just come out. Lake Poopó is considered the second largest lake of Bolivia after Lake Titicaca, and it has virtually disappeared. This lake, formerly home of multitudes of endemic species, is now dry and full of dead fish and dead animals. And it's pretty devastating looking. You think, is this really natural? You know, some areas are just having extreme droughts, and meanwhile, the other areas are having extreme floods. So it's this world of extremes, and, you know, around here we've had what feels like too much rain, and then in places like this, they're completely drying up. This lake, which has been a source of income for many fishing families in the region, has dried up into a vast salt desert. Boats laying on the sand there used to be 84 kilometers long and 55 kilometers wide, an area of about 4,620 square kilometers. Now it's the size of a puddle, and it's just surrounded by desert 2 months. That's what's really the odd part, right? What's going on that a whole giant, huge lake that's been there for a very long time to completely dry up in just 2 months, big ecological disaster. What's going on in Bolivia? What is going on with this weather? Certainly doesn't look like something Mother Nature would be doing. It seems that water levels of the lake can vary enormously, but never as dry as it's been now. So when people wonder about the effects of climate change, oh, is it happening? Oh, we just happen to have a warm day. Oh, I love global warming. You know, the realities are much more intense out there when it comes to the climate truly changing. By whomever's hands, and by the movements of nature and how we have affected it adversely. Meanwhile, we have a chance to turn a corner. Of course, the Paris meeting had a bunch of people throwing in their hats, over 200 countries saying, yeah, let's make some great changes. Non-binding, sure, we'll agree. We won't really agree legally, but we'll sort of agree in spirit. But we need those binding agreements. We need serious pace toward really getting the carbon sequester, the grant drawing down that carbon, going back at the same direction nature does to sequester that carbon, to clean our air, to clean our soil and our water. And, of course, meanwhile, we've got developing countries like China looking at building a whole bunch more coal-fired plants. And really, we're looking at the coal demand growth era needing to come to an end because we're burning up our atmosphere as well as desecrating mountains and forests and ecosystems to dig up that coal, heat up our atmosphere in the process. So some folks are saying the era of strong coal demand growth is over. Yes, some people are really getting out there and declaring it out there. There's tremendous happening from the Chinese downturn and new decisions after some data on climate and people really realizing what are we going to do? Go down that dead end road. They've already got record breaking levels of pollution in China. Air pollution so bad that people have to walk around with masks on, extremely tough to breathe over there. We have to have the drive for energy efficiency. And the International Energy Agency, over their findings that global coal demand has stalled in the face of tremendous pressures from a downturn in use in China, and action on global climate change have reignited calls from environmentalists and others for Australia to prepare for a future without the fuel as well. In its annual outlook for coal, the closely watched IEA slashed its five-year forecast for coal demand growth by more than 500 million tons and admitted what several environmental organizations have been claiming, that coal use in China may have peaked a couple of years ago. Shani Tagar of Greenpeace Australia says the Paris talks were the first admission that the age of fossil fuels is coming to an end, and this report is another nail in coal's coffin. Well, you know, it's honestly nails in our own coffin sooner and miserable quality of life if we just continue using the dirty forms of energy that have dominated our global energy supplies for the better part of the last 100 years. It's been time to move on for a long time. We're just at the absolute end of the road with it, but, you know, we didn't have to wait this long. Of course, the monopolies and lobbies and different unethical practices out there have fueled that. But it's really our own well-being here, all of us. And just because some are far more wealthy than others doesn't mean their well-being is really any better off in the end if we're burning up the planet, right? So with clean green energy is the new innovative way to go. It's the way to do it. We can do it. There's tons of great ideas out there, tons of great inventors, fantastic companies to be invested in, decisions to be made by both municipalities, cities, counties, states, countries, coalitions of countries, entire continents. It's time for us to bring together the team, right? The Earth Stewardship Team, magnifying love from the heart, taking action, living our purpose passionately and powerfully together. Every day, one step at a time, we do make a difference. Let's get this era of very unsustainable energy just done with. It's time to do it, right? It's time to move along and get down to some serious sustainable living on this beautiful planet that we all share and celebrate. So great to see, and let's be brave. Let's go ahead and be brave and just get rid of the junk that we don't need. With the nasty energy that hurts everyone and everything and all of nature, and just go ahead and start replacing that. We don't need to keep propping up the anachronistic dinosaurs of our past and our fossil fuels, our literal dinosaurs distilled down into this oil in the earth that we are pumping up and doing things backwards, right? It's about putting the coal in the ground, sequestering with dynamic carbon smart gardening, moving into more green spaces. Congratulations, Asheville, North Carolina, looking at a vastly increased greenways program, more in the next few years coming than they've done in the last 30 years. More greenways everywhere is what we need. Great to see that progress happening here, right here locally. Brand new story out in the Asheville Citizen Times. Check it out. Mega expanded greenways plan. People want to live near those greenways so they can walk and bike and be healthy and enjoy a great quality of life. And, of course, it improves the air. Having more plants, drawing down more carbon, keeping our forests, keeping our diversity out there, it's what makes quality of life happen for our air. And, you know, the plants are smart, right? The plants are smart. They are working to create the entire habitat of where animals are living. All of these things happen, and you know, we're finding out more all the time. This just posted yesterday by Sayer G, founder there at GreenMed Info. Research empowered And yes, new research revealing plants can think, choose, and remember. We are being awed when we are looking at some of this new plant research. Modern science is just beginning to catch up to some of the wisdom of the ancients. Plants possess sentience and a rudimentary form of intelligence. Plants now being acknowledged as being far more intelligent and capable than we've ever given them credit. In fact, provocative research from 2010 published in Plant Signaling and Behavior proposes that since they cannot escape environmental stresses in the manner of animals, they have developed sophisticated, highly responsive, and dynamic physiology. And that physiology of plant intelligence, directed physiology, is what feeds us and helps heal us. And that's why it's so important for us to be in relationship with plants and to eat lots of vegetables and to support our health that way. We've got information coming together talking about very complex processes plants are performing, such as biological quantum computing. Yes, the equivalent of biological quantum computing is going on. Cellular light memory is happening. It can be described as forms of plant intelligence many different ways that we're seeing the dimensionality of the intelligence of life around us. Of course, secret life of plants, from memory to intelligence. That study highlights one particular superpower of plants, indicative of their success as intelligent beings. There are living trees that germinated thousands of years ago. What kind of wisdom evolved in plants to make it possible to survive and propagate for so long in the same place where they were first germinated? That seed came to life in that spot, and thousands of years later, that plant is still there. Through all of our desecration and decimation of our natural world, through all of our wars, through all of our baloney that we have perpetrated here on Earth, and through all of the goodness and through all the saints and the wonders, that one tree has remained. And ancient life forms remain in the form of plants all over the earth. And they are connected through a dynamic and intricate network of communication and dynamic exchange of nutrients and more intelligence so that they can understand the biospheres and the ecosystems that they're connected in across distances, even great distances. Plants and nature is communicating with itself. It's phenomenal. Gardening and farming and working with horticulture, we are engaging in some of the most intelligent and intricate interactions and relationships possible on Earth. According to the researchers, plants actually work as a biological quantum computing device that is capable of processing quantum information encrypted in light intensity and in its energy. This information processing includes a mechanism for processing memorized information. For example, plants can store and use information from the spectral composition of light for several days or more, and they use that to anticipate changes that might appear in the near future in the environment. For example, the anticipation of pathogen attack. Plants think and remember. They actually think and remember. And so that's why having the natural processes that nature is living and breathing in to keep those intact is utterly vital, so that plants are able to be communicating with their environment, with the atmosphere, and are able to act accordingly and begin to generate the dynamic physiological chemical responses to adapt accordingly. And so honoring the intelligence of life forms in plants and engaging their biodiversity allows them to really perform on that ultra-quantum level by having them in interaction not only with the earth but with themselves. A biodiverse plant community and many different plant guilds in harmony, working together in communication, is the cornerstone of a dynamically healthy ecosystem. Plants not only possess a mechanism for information gathering and processing, but they appear to exercise agency or choice vis-a-vis different scenarios. They're actually choosing. Different groups of chloroplasts and cells in the same leaf, under identical constant and stable light, temperature, and relative humidity conditions, different opinions. Different chloroplasts, the little cells in one leaf, will do different things and perform different functions in the exact same conditions, deciding what to do as they test different scenarios of possible future development. This is a new world, really, when we begin to truly understand how alive and how intelligent the plants that feed us are. The plants that put the oxygen in our air, they are our keepers in a way, our life givers. And that's why we've got to protect them. Protecting the forest, planting more seeds, more gardens, more community spaces. It's so wonderful to see this information coming out. And thank you to Sayer Ji, founder of Green Med Info. He's also on the Board of Governors for the National Health Federation. Great to hear his information. He's also a member of the Global GMO Free Coalition and a reviewer at the International Journal of Human Nutrition and Functional Medicine. So plants. Plants and their extreme intelligence. And that's why we've got to really look to the natural world to be wise. Humans just seem insanely stupid these days in many ways, don't they? Our civilization in a big way just making these giant mistakes that are pretty unrecoverable for the most part when we engage nature and turn things around. But still, there are bright spots on the horizon, and we always have the chance to make a better choice, to make that investment in sustainable green energy businesses, to make the organic food choice that day, to get up and go ahead and exercise and let your body feel alive and feed yourself the proper way, to feed your mind the energizing thoughts that are going to help your soul expand and be a great earth steward so that we can do this together and have fun in the process. There are bright spots in each of us as we light up our heart, our truth, our passion and purpose. That's the brightest spots, right? Those are the billions of stars that shine the horizon into the dawn here of the new day of a sustainable culture. It's us. We're doing it. We can do it more. Every minute we can be better and choose better. But in the meanwhile, we've got to unplug from the poison, right? Unplug from the ecocidal industries. Unplug from all the deadly scenarios that we've dreamed up for ourselves and start living the dream of love and togetherness. We can do it. And we can do it in very real ways. And I love seeing this kind of progress going on. Congratulations to the former Costco executive. He's been working extremely hard with his team because he's opening a fast food chain unlike anything that exists so far in America. Yes, thank you to Business Insider Haley Peterson for just bringing this out there on Yahoo Finance. Former Costco executive is launching America's first fast food chain that has been certified organic by the USDA. Erica Welton was a food buyer for Costco for 14 years before leaving to launch the restaurant chain called The Organic Coup. She said, "We saw this huge shift happening at Costco with people purchasing more and more organic food," Welton told the insider. She said she bought into the trend as well, started purchasing mostly organic and unprocessed foods for her own family. But when she was pressed for time, she had few options for quick organic meals on the go. "No fast food places available. Nope, it's all just toxic if you're in a hurry." So she saw that market niche, and I've seen it forever, right? I thought, why doesn't somebody open an organic fast food place? It would be the only one out there. People would go bananas for it. They would love it. No one did it until Erica Welton. Chipotle is a great option, but we didn't want to eat there for every meal. We wanted more choices, so she launched Organic Coup. The first location opened last month in Pleasanton, California. Welton plans to open 25 more restaurants over the next 14 months, mainly on the West Coast. Hey, I want one over here. I want one over here. Come on. Come on, Erica. We've got to talk her into it. I know she will. Maybe she'll put one in Asheville, right? Asheville's on every number one super-de-duper list, so it will be great press for her. So maybe we can get her to do a little East Coast grounding for her new venture. I'm very excited for her. What a great idea. Congratulations, Erica. She wants to expand to include cities like Las Vegas, New York City, Austin, and Chicago. Oh, yeah, we can definitely get her to bring one to Asheville. I'm feeling it. Welton went through the process of getting the chain certified by the USDA because she wanted customers to be able to trust their promise for organic food. Organic Coop, she didn't really understand how restaurants were certified. At first, she was shocked to find out that they were America's first certified organic fast food chain. So you know she had to blaze some trails there, because this stuff doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen easily, and she probably had to, you know, really open up some new channels for this, because it's never been done. Sometimes you're just the one that goes first. You're blazing the trail there, and then you make a pathway for others. So look for more fast food chains. You know it's going to be great, and you know people are going to get inspired. She's blazed the trail, and now there's a pathway for others to follow. So they're doing things in a quality way, and you know what? People will pay for it. I'll pay for it. I'm happy to pay more for something that's worth eating. Why pay a little bit less for something that's worthless? It's not even worthless. It's dangerously damaging to eat. So much of the food out there with pesticides and all this GMO stuff in there, it's not just nutritionally deficient. It's actually damaging to our health. So I will pay for food that's worth eating, and I love that there will be more options out there for people. They're doing things great. They've got organic air-chilled chicken fried in coconut oil. They've got vegetarian options. Yes, they've chosen coconut oil. It's the most expensive oil they could have chosen, but it's got good plant-based fats, no cholesterol, high in vitamin A, super healthy stuff, and they are doing it, making that commitment to go organic so that more people, thousands more people, can make that choice if they're out there and on the go. Organic Coop. I am so excited for Erica Welton. They've got a simple menu. Customers can get the fried chicken with a range of sauces on a bun, a multigrain wrap, a bowl with shredded vegetables. The only side available is organic popcorn covered in caramel and drizzled with chocolate. They've got Costco mindset, focusing on doing one thing great. They're really focusing on the organic fried chicken and then a bunch of stuff around that. It's a little pricier than your average fast food restaurant, but of course the food is quality, so that's worth it. Fried chicken sandwich is about $8.99 compared to under $4 for a GMO chicken sandwich elsewhere. Hey, I don't want a GMO chicken sandwich. I'd rather pay more than double for something I want. It's fine. That's great. But a lot of people out there, more and more people, are willing to pay for organic food. The restaurant has only been open about 4 weeks. It already has racked up nearly 100 reviews on Yelp and Facebook. Yes, on Yelp, Organic Coop has a rating of 4.5 out of 5 stars. One reviewer described the chicken as juicy, tender, and spicy. Delicious stuff. Great reviews happening. Congratulations, Organic Coop. Haley Peterson, thanks for bringing us that story. And Erica Welton, bravo. First fast food chain organically certified in the United States of America. Yes, we're doing it. Out in California, out west, they're going to get a whole bunch of those organic fast food places. It's going to be great. Out west, a lot of things happen. And oftentimes, it becomes the bar that makes us aware of other things ahead of many, many other places where it's a lot more behind. But then sometimes, we have some precedents set in California that are a little scary. One happening right now, we've got it in progress. Yes, California alert. Largest release of methane in California history. And they cannot seem to stop it. We've got a giant stream. Gas about 26 times more damaging for the atmosphere than the excess of carbon. Methane. Yes, methane is blowing hundreds of feet into the air in Los Angeles County. For the 7th week in a row. I've reported on this already. And now 7 weeks on, we've got a release that is vast, vast release of methane. If you look at the thermographic imaging of it and the spectrography on it, it is this huge plume of methane going out over populated areas, neighborhoods kind of like in the old E.T. movie, you know, these old California neighborhoods, that kind of neighborhood. This giant stream of potent climate warming gas spewing into L.A. County 7 weeks in a row now. This release cancels out hundreds of smaller efforts over more than a decade to clamp down on escapes of the gas. A priority because in the short term, methane is far more powerful climate warming gas than carbon dioxide. What is up with this uncontrollable leak going on? Pilots flying low have been told by the Federal Aviation Administration to stay clear of the plume for fear of ignition. You can light the whole air up. Poof! You've got so much hundreds of millions of gallons of methane spewing into the air over there right now. Literally, we could have a mass combustion of air through an ignited process out there in Southern California right now. The air could catch on fire, like in a big way across a big area. Pretty wild, isn't it? You think that we'd have done something about it by now, but we're almost 2 months into this. Southern California Gas Company officials say it will be months before it can be stopped. Yes, it's their leak at a gas well there. More than 1,800 families have had to relocate already due to the vapors. Could ignite any minute. We've got toxification going on. The mainly methane gas is pouring out of the ground near a damaged well used to inject gas into an old sandstone oil field for storage. What they're saying there is Tim O'Connor, who used to inspect major facilities like refineries for the Bay Area Air Quality Management District and works for the Environmental Defense Fund, says, I think what we are seeing is probably one of the single largest releases of methane in California history. Infrared images are making it possible to see the massive escape of methane and other gases from the Aliso Canyon gas storage field in Los Angeles County. It is a huge infrared spewing toxic methane-like air volcano that's invisible. It's able to be seen with infrared. You can see the massive escape along with the other gases, methane and a combination of other gases from that Aliso Canyon storage field. People that they're talking to there are saying it's the biggest, most complex leak they have ever seen. Authorities estimate the rupture in the well, perhaps more than a mile deep, is sending 100,000 pounds of methane into the air per hour. Oh, we don't have a climate problem. Let's just go uncontrollable with a corporation blasting super damaging climate gases into the air. These are the kinds of things that are really unrecoverable. We're just making more problems for ourselves continuously. Why are they allowed to keep doing this? There should be some kind of super emergency ability to control a leak like this, or we shouldn't be digging wells like that. If we can't handle the water hose, we don't need to be turning on the spigot. And this is huge, just heinous levels of irresponsibility going on here. Again, just like Fukushima with the nuclear not being able to be managed well in a disaster. Authorities estimate the rupture is sending out, as I said, 100,000 pounds of methane per hour. Methane traps heat far more powerfully than carbon dioxide during its approximately 20-year stay in the atmosphere. So we're just blasting our next 20 years right now over in California out the wazoo. Who knows what we're doing? Who knows what the real effects are going to be? Scientists help us see, but who really knows? We've never had anything like this. Biggest leak in history. Can't help but think there's some kind of perhaps sabotage or something. I mean, this just seems uncanny, right? Very unusual. And to say, oh, it's going to go on for months? What is up with that? Shouldn't take months to fix something like this that's this devastating. This is an outsized role in rising sea levels and disrupted weather by allowing this spew to go on. The Aliso Canyon gas storage field covered with wells is owned by Southern California Gas Company. What are you doing, Southern California Gas Company? This is a subsidiary of Sempra Energy based in San Diego. Get everybody up there and take care of this. We really need to wait months to get down that mile. I'm from Texas. You know what? We dig all kinds of wells over there. They already messed up the Gulf, right? We've already wrecked the Gulf by the BP oil spill. But there's thousands of wells all over Texas. People have to be able to get in there and shut that thing down. Come on, Southern California Gas, let's do this. It's very unusual. What's going on? They've never had an escape this large, says Gillian Wright, Vice President for Customer Service for Southern California Gas. He says, I really have to emphasize, this is an extremely rare event. Well, I'd rather it be so rare that it never happens. And now that it has happened, let's shut her down. You know, I mean, we can't just sit around and say, oh, it's going to take months because we weren't financially prepared to handle our business. And, you know, that's usually what makes nature suffer the most in the face of these irresponsible ecocidal disasters is, oh, they didn't have the little savings account over there and the billions of dollars ready to mobilize in case of this kind of an event. That is part of what happens when you're doing this kind of business. We weren't really financially prepared for wrecking the environment and taking responsibility for it. That is the definition of ecocidal industry. Industries who are going to make money by exploiting the earth and its resources, but yet don't keep the money ready to remediate and take care of things, but want to damage, and then keep raking in the money at the cost of everyone else and the whole world and on the whole collective of our quality of life. That is the definition of ecocide, an ecocidal industry. And that's why we've got to do things differently. So I'm wondering how this is going to fare for the air quality of people living down in Los Angeles. I've got some family there. You know, my nephews live over there and some others and you know, lots of friends. How is this affecting their quality of life? Is that part of the cost factored in when they invested in this gas? Well, Southern California Gas Company, no. A diminishing quality of life for everyone? That's a liability right there. They don't even know how to handle the mistake that's been made in this case. And they say they have to really emphasize it's rare and the extent and the difficulty of resolving this leak are highly, highly unusual. Well, can't you tell that when you're making a highly, highly risky investment in a well that's going to blow like that, that it maybe could do that? Especially when we live in an area like California where it's just filled with earthquakes, too. I mean, you know, that's not even being factored in here. All the methods the company has tried so far to kill the well have failed. Now experts who fought the Kuwaiti oil field fires are joining the effort. The safety of some 100 workers on the site is also a concern. Wright said they are wondering why on some days the company cannot perform certain work if the wind is blowing methane over certain equipment. The crews cannot start the equipment because it'll blow. This is a unique situation, this methane gas threat that's going on, this spewing of 100,000 pounds of methane per hour. That's what's going on right there in L.A. County. As of this past weekend, 1,800 families ill or frightened by the sulfurous gas drifting down from the site have been relocated from Porter Ranch, paid for by the gas company, but they're not paying for the damages to our climate, right? That's this hidden cost that's vast. They can't afford it. No company can afford to destroy the earth, really. If those costs are calculated, that's not affordable. It's not affordable for any company. It's unsustainable. An additional 1,433 families have been asked to move. Some are still deciding, but it's getting pretty imminent. It's, you know, things are happening, and we're the ones pulling the switches and pushing the buttons and causing most of the problems. So we could just get ourselves together, get some focus about what we're really doing, stop doing things that we know are going to damage our life on Earth, and start to make better decisions. Several lawsuits have been filed. Marquee environmental litigators are partnering in the effort. They liken the release to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon well blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. At a gathering December 9th organized by lawyers, they struck at residents' deepest fears. Everyone there has suffered a huge property loss. The secret is out. There's a bomb underneath you. He invited those in attendance to sign up to be represented by counsel. The chart that they have here in this article details the amount of natural gas stored underground in 31 states. Michigan. Hey, Michigan, guess what? You've got about 950 million cubic feet leading the country, number one. Illinois, 918 plus cubic million feet of natural gas being stored underground. Texas, over 725,652 cubic million cubic feet. And the list goes on and on. Mostly, okay, the top in order is Michigan, Illinois, Texas, Pennsylvania, L.A. It says L.A. I guess that's just meaning Louisiana here. California, Ohio, West Virginia, Oklahoma. And going on down the list, we get to North Carolina. I don't even see it on there. Well, I'm glad to know that. Glad to know I'm not sitting on a methane time bomb. So lots of people are waking up to this new threat because humans, of course, are fallible, and we build these wells that blow. So we've got to be able to be aware of what we might be sitting on top of. Officials who have focused on reducing methane emissions because of the impact on the Earth's atmosphere have paid more attention to regulations on pipelines and wells and other places from which methane escapes. They have not been looking at these storage systems. And now we've got this thing holding 86 billion cubic feet of gas possible. It's the heart of their system in terms of supplying and managing their demand. And it is just spewing. O'Connor of the Environmental Defense Fund said the gas gushing from Aliso Canyon is roughly equal to that emitted by 6 coal-fired power plants or 7 million extra cars. So they've got 7 million extra cars equivalent just spewing right now. And somehow they can't seem to stop it. Wow. That's just an unmanageable type of business model. You can't be able to build that kind of thing if you cannot manage it. That should be illegal. We've got to, you know, as they're saying, I think we have found a regulatory gap. Yes, I think we have a massive regulatory and responsibility gap going on here. Officials at both the federal and state level are formulating new rules now for reducing emissions of methane. Underground natural gas storage is likely to get far more scrutiny coming up in the near future. Earth Art Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition, where we tie together all of the issues, we bring them together, we bring insight, we look at how things are really connected, and that's a good thing. And sometimes it can be a really scary thing to realize. If maybe if you're sitting in that neighborhood with 7 million cars worth of pollution of methane spewing all over the place and your air could ignite any minute. I guess the smokers are leaving town. Huh? The smokers that want to walk out and smoke cigarettes out there. No more of that in the neighborhood, huh? Pretty wild what's going on in Los Angeles County, of all places. Los Angeles County is already suing Monsanto for long-term contamination of the LA Basin. Really amazing how when you look into the complete history of Monsanto, many people call it the world's most evil corporation. I don't really like to put those kinds of terms on anything, but, you know, it's quite amazing what goes on. Of all the mega corporations out there running amok, Monsanto has consistently outperformed its rivals. They've got that crown, yes, that people are considering them quite evil, but it's read up on the history. You know, there really is a history with these companies and just this history of just death and destruction. We've got them being brought into the international court, the criminal court in The Hague, international criminal charges being brought against Monsanto for ecocide and crimes against nature and humanity. Yes, the word is out. Pretty bad stuff. Let's get into some ethical business. Let's get into honoring nature. And let's start composting some of our unsustainable technologies and some of our unsustainable ways in society and start composting that and planting new seeds. Because nature's always teaching us how to do it. And we just have to quit doing the wrong stuff and start heeding the wise words of nature. And sometimes it's just having that silent respect for even a simple insect. Simple insects are some of the most heroic participants out there, transforming the soil, transforming plants, pollinating, feeding us. And, you know, I have to say, ever since I was a child, one little insect used to really fascinate me. And I used to pick them up and play with them. And, of course, I thought I was tickling them. I would touch their little feet, and their feet would move around. I thought, in my mind, I was tickling the roly-polies. You know those little roly-polies? That's what we call them, right? Of course, that's not their scientific name, but roly-polies are quite magnificent. You might not even know it. I just spotted a rather large roly-poly in my peace lily plant the other day, and I was kind of amazed here, and she started noticing something moving in the plant, and I looked in there to find a very large roly-poly. I think that's his entire condo over there, that peace lily plant. But I want to leave him in there. They're very beneficial. I didn't even really know what they did, but I've always noticed them. And you notice them anywhere you go, right? If you pull back the grass from the sidewalk and you look where the dirt meets the concrete there and the grass is trying to cover it up and grow in between, you always find some roly-polies. And I have just found out what an amazing little creature they are. Roly-polies actually remove heavy metals from soil They stabilize growing conditions and they protect groundwater. And you know what we've got happening, and of course we've had hundreds of people around the world testing and confirming that we are indeed being sprayed with all kinds of geoengineered chemicals. It's been admitted. There's been all kinds of conferences and things like that. But a ton of heavy metals being spewed out there. And meanwhile, we've got roly-polies over there that are able to help work with this stuff. And the first thing, of course, we need to do is stop spraying junk in the air to manipulate the weather. But the main thing we need to do is support nature. And roly-polies are supporting us in transforming those heavy metals. So neat to learn about this. Yes, turn over a brick or a board, and all of a sudden you look under there, and they call them pill bugs, right? Little pill bugs. The roly-polies, or wood lice, they're also called, the gray-colored little creatures. They're in moist environments that are dark, and they feed on decaying matter. What's interesting about them is that they are not even insects. Nope, they're not even insects, and that's why I was having so much fun tickling all their little legs. They have so many legs, more than six, right? Far more than six. They are actually crustaceans. They are crustaceans, and they're more closely like crabs and shrimp in their anatomy than insects. And so these are actually little crustaceans, and you notice their little exoskeleton. You know, they have a little shell, and they look quite ancient. They can roll up in that famous little ball when they get a little worried or want to be shy for a moment. They roll up into a ball when they feel threatened. And another unique feature they have is that they have seven pairs of legs. I never knew. 14. 14 legs. Yes, seven pairs. They also act like kangaroos, toting their eggs around with them in a special pouch. Can you believe this? I had no idea. Roly-polies have a special pouch called marsupium. Just like marsupials, just like kangaroos and possums, they've got a little pouch. Their little marsupium is on their underside. Even stranger, they do not urinate. No, they exchange gases through gill-like structures. So I have learned so much about these little roly-polies, thanks to naturalnews.com. I love stories like this. They have seven pairs of legs. They have a little pouch for their babies. And they don't even urinate. Isn't that a trip? And they're crustaceans. They are crustaceans. So, gills. And they're great for gardens and composting. Breeding or collecting these roly-polies may be an important practice for homesteading and gardening. The guts of these pill bugs contain a number of microbes that help the critter feed on dead organic matter. By releasing mass quantities of pill bugs into a mature garden, one can be assured that dead plant matter is being properly broken down and returned to healthy soil. Pill bugs literally speed up the process of decomposition. They circulate the soil. They can be very useful in composting. Treats for pill bugs include fungus and monocotyledonous leaves. I had no idea. We should be cultivating roly-polies. We should be breeding legions of roly-polies, right? And that will help our compost and our gardens. And what is that? Working with nature. And they also can help us break down those heavy metals that accumulate in soil. Because heavy metals accumulating in soil shut down root growth and shut down nutrient uptake of plants. So roly-polies are really our allies, as are all insects and many of those creatures out there that we forget to acknowledge or that we just start to realize how amazing they are. They play an important role in the cycle of healthy plant life. They return organic matter to the soil so it can be digested further by fungi, protozoa, and bacteria. This process produces a natural supply of nitrates, phosphates, and other vital nutrients that plants need to thrive now and in future growing seasons. So that little roly-poly, well, rather large roly-poly in my peace lily over there, is actually helping the plant grow. Isn't that wonderful? Thank you, roly-poly over there. He can hear me. You know, he's in there. He doesn't know I'm talking about him, but of course he's in there. He's just a couple of feet from me in there. It's important, it says, not to introduce pill bugs into the garden too early, as they can munch on emerging plants. Yes, they can eat the emerging ones, but those little gray soil workers can live up to 3 years. So you want to get them increasing in the garden that is more established. Pill bugs clean up the soil. They protect the groundwater from heavy metal contamination. This unique crustacean possesses an ability to safely remove heavy metal. Isn't that amazing? For this reason, they are an important tool for cleaning up soil contaminated with pollutants like lead, cadmium, arsenic. In coal spoils and slag heaps, pill bugs come in handy. They take in heavy metals like lead and cadmium and crystallize these ions in their gut. They crystallize the ions in their gut of the heavy metals. They're like little tanks processing that stuff. The heavy metal toxins are then made deposits in the midgut. With this special cleanup property, the roly-polies have survived where most creatures cannot, in the most contaminated places. And that's why we see them on the edges of sidewalks in cities, in those places where nature still dares to tread, in those supposedly sanitized areas where everything else is dead and cold and lifeless. You'll find a roly-poly. A roly-poly bringing back that circle of life, just like they do when they roll up. They can survive in those contaminated places and help to remediate and clean up the soil and the water. The magic of the pill bug helps reestablish healthy soils and prevents toxic metal ions from leaching into the groundwater with their specially designed heavy metal ionizing gut. How amazing. Like, we're just learning about the wonders of our own gut, never mind those of insects like the amazing roly-poly. Pill bugs are protecting well water from becoming contaminated while stabilizing soils. Love this. Just love learning. I love learning about the amazingness of the creatures that surround us, and that something as common and overlooked and unappreciated and just forgotten about out there, the roly-poly bug, is an absolute wonder of a crustacean that's right there with us working on making that soil better. And what happens when we have better soil? We have better plants growing in that soil, more nutritious food growing in that soil. We have proven broccoli, foods, things that are grown in healthy organic soil are far more nutrient dense, far more able to feed ourselves and our healthy bodies than plants that are covered in pesticides and grown in sterile soils that are being mined and pumped in with chemicals and synthetic fertilizers. We know organic food is better for us and better for the soil and better for the planet. And we all of us need to be eating more vegetables. Yes, we are acidic. We eat too much meat. We get around too many electronics. We're accumulating biopollution in our electric circuits in our bodies, and we're not eating enough alkalizing vegetables. We're not getting out there grounding on the earth enough and sucking out those positively charged ions that make those waves of inflammation and musculoskeletal pain go throughout our bodies. We all need to be eating more vegetables. And guess what? Thank you to sfgate.com. It is amazing. Susanna Guerrero tells us about a new survey finding only about 4% of Americans eat enough vegetables. The health statistics bear it out. 96% of Americans are not eating enough vegetables. And when it comes to eating those vegetables, Americans really aren't doing much better than, you know, your average school kid eating the junk that they're eating at the schools. Only about 4% of Americans meet their daily required consumption of vegetables. According to the National Fruit and Vegetable Alliance, their 2015 report card has given consumption of vegetables among children a D grade. And you know what that means? That means that they're not functioning intellectually the way they should, because more vegetables means you're a healthier person. So we've got these malnourished kids out there eating too much meat and not enough vegetables, or eating too much junk food. They've got a D grade, not enough vegetables being eaten, and the marketing of vegetables has received an F. You know, you don't see the big flashy commercial for broccoli, right? You don't see a big fancy romantic sexy commercial for carrots. You know, you see all this stuff that's glamorized that's extremely detrimental to eat, detrimental to our bodies. We aren't marketing it, but we can be doing it. Organic people, organic farmers are out there marketing their stuff. People are buying it, but still, we could be bringing more awareness to eating those vegetables. It's really a key to our health and making sure that they're organic vegetables grown in nutrient-dense soil, grown with healthy, biodiverse ecosystems that are alive and surrounding those gardens. Even with the growing popularity of vegetable-forward type restaurants and veggie-inspired meals, there is still a big lack of vegetables consumed in homes. The 2015 report card from the Food and Vegetable Fruit and Vegetable Alliance says that the problem is getting worse. The average consumption of vegetables, which excludes fried potatoes, declined by 6% during the past 5 years. The report offers a reason why this might be the case. Dinner looks different these days. The growing popularity of convenient items and one-dish meals like pizza and sandwiches has pushed the vegetable side dish off the plate. And so we're leaving out vegetables too often. When it comes to preparing meals at home, the article suggests that parents may not be as strict on making sure their kids have enough vegetables. Elizabeth Pavanka, registered dietitian and president and CEO of the Produce for Better Health Foundation, explains that parents don't want to be line cooks and make tailored meals for everyone at home, but we've really got to make sure we're getting those vegetables. One-third of parents, 35% of you, getting their kids to eat vegetables as a battle. Of course, we've got the famous, you know, kids that won't eat anything but things like Jell-O and mac and cheese. But you know what I've noticed? The parents train them in a way to expect that they're going to hate vegetables. I've watched so many parents offer vegetables to kids like it was Raid or something, or, you know, roach poison. Like, oh, you want to try this? Like, it's going to be awful. And they train the kids to hate the vegetables. And meanwhile, the kids are sick. They end up with a bunch of allergies. They end up being badly behaved. So eat more vegetables. I don't know what that noise is over there, but I know we've got Patrick Battle on the line, and he's a big vegetable eater. Patrick is a greens pioneer that makes sure we remember to eat our greens and even teaches us how to grow them throughout the winter. So great to have you with us, Patrick, and happy solstice to you.
Happy solstice to you also. It's another amazingly warm day. I'm thoroughly enjoying it and trying not to think of the consequences.
Right.
You know, I actually have a story on the line of kids and vegetables. As a little boy, my dad and I had epic struggles over me eating broccoli and whatever. And my dad managed hotels, so I lived in the hotel, and my favorite hangout was back in the kitchen with the wait staff and the cooks and all that. I mean, they'd let me be around, and, you know, it was someplace if I didn't have a friend to play with, I'd hang out back there. And there was a chef who just blew away my dad because he had me eating every vegetable. And he just never, ever tried to make me eat any of them, but just, like, challenged me to give him a try and said, you know, I bet you'd like it, try. And I ate every vegetable and did like it, you know. And it was simply because instead of it being adversarial, it was simply like, hey, there's an adventure you can have. You don't have to take it, but if you want to, you can have that adventure.
Yeah, not providing that backstop for resistance, right? Sometimes just gets people to take that little step out there past their limitation and saying, hey, go ahead and explore. That's wonderful.
Anyway, we are coming into the high season of celebration for a lot of us, and it's a good time to think about what can you do from your garden to heighten that, you know. And there's oftentimes stuff that is, you know, left in your garden, flowers and whatnot, greens and stuff that have dried, freeze-dried, or whatever, that can be added to your displays, you know. There's also probably foods out there you don't even know you have. Like, I just noticed there are volunteer garlics popping up here and there everywhere. And anybody who was trying to make sure that they have a little bit of taste from their garden, even if they didn't get a fall, winter garden in, might go out there and find that there's some. The chives have not died back yet. They're quite abundant still. So you may have forgotten about your chive bunch and think, oh, I don't have much of anything in the garden, but you might still have a lot of food kicking around there because it's been so mild. So I encourage people to get out there and take a look and take a walk through their garden. Maybe they think they're done with the garden for the year, but there might be a bunch of gifts left to gather from the garden. And, of course, there'll be that connection that even in the dead of winter we have. And another one that I want to remind people of, because I haven't done it yet, it's been so mild, If you're leaving bulbs like dahlias in the ground, things that you're hoping to have over winter that don't always overwinter here if it freezes hard, remember, while the ground's still warm, to get out there and give a good layer of mulch, thick layer of leaves or straw or whatever, to that to those bulbs so that they make it through the likely deep cold that we'll see yet. Maybe we won't see deep cold this year. 2011, we really never saw any deep cold. But the average year, we get down there into the low double digits at least, if not the single digits, and every 3 to 4 years, 2 years in a row now, we've done it well below zero. So remember to get out there and do that mulching. And also, folks, I mean, I've said it before, but now's the time to be thinking about fava beans. This is a great time of year to put your fava beans in the ground.
Great. Well, that is a good reminder to have again, because you have given so many wonderful, absolutely luscious descriptions of just how wonderful of a delicacy they are to have those delicious fava beans. It makes me want them. And, you know, Pat, I didn't put bows on them or wrap them or anything, but I've been giving lots of gifts from the garden to the little voles. Yes, they have come. I've been finding hollowed out turnips and eating up stuff, and boy, they love my Joan rutabagas. They're going for them.
Oh, yeah. They'll tear those up. You know, if you're losing them big time, you might decide, okay, storing in the ground is not the route, and what I need to do is just call it quits, you know?
Well, I went ahead, and after I saw a thoroughly eaten, beautiful daikon and some very hollowed out, interesting stuff done with the turnips and the rutabagas there, I don't even know how. It did it. It was like the whole thing looked whole, but the whole inside was empty, and then this gelatinous stuff was forming in there. But I was like, uh-oh, you know, cut the greens for the chickens. They were pretty wilted. And then go out there and just pick some. And, wow, yesterday, just a quick little boil of some of those rutabagas with a little bit of olive oil, garlic, and salt, pepper, and some garlic and fresh onion thrown in right at the end with the greens, and just a most satisfying and delicious vegetable. Went ahead and picked some. They're a little smaller. I got them in slightly late, but hopefully I can feed some of the voles. I don't know how greedy they're going to get, but they're definitely out there now.
Oh, they'll eat every last bit of your roots if you don't bring them in. You know, if you don't decide that, okay, I'm done trying to grow this. The voles have decided that they want it. They'll eat it out. I mean, it's winter time. They want food. You're going to suddenly decide, okay, it's time to leave Lisa her share. You know?
Yeah, I saw them, you know, eat one, and then there'd be a nice one next to it. And I thought, well, you know, how many do I have? How full can they get? I did have the famous Monet pastel tulip garden, you know, beautiful, artful flower bed that I planted in Cherokee many years ago, and 150-something bulbs with all these layers of pastel colors just dreaming about my Easter garden, and went out there to find, you know, 150 little holes in
yep.
the springtime. So I've had it happen.
It will happen. I mean, eventually, they may not find you right away, but they will find you, and they will eat everything when they do find you, you know. I've learned once they found me that it's time to cut my losses, harvest my crop, and try a different place, you know. And I don't know if I've said this on this show yet, but, you know, I probably have. We purposely grow our sweet potatoes where most of the crew thought they can't possibly work. The soil's way too heavy. Can't have this heavy soil. And the sweet potatoes totally handle it, as will daikon, as will rutabagas. They show that they're working, you know. They show they're working. There's, you know, the sweet potatoes are almost corkscrews at times, you know. And the daikon and the radishes may have some contortions as they work their way through the soil. But they will actually not be bothered by voles at all, because it's just too much work for the voles to get into that incredibly rough soil. So if you've got some heavy clay soil and you have vole problems with roots, it's time to move into your heavy clay soil and grow your roots there. You know, that's the downside of all the stuff that we know how to do to make the soil get better and better. It's also getting better and better for those hungry little critters.
Right, right. It is. They're having a blast out there. I'm getting to share the abundance of the garden, and just got to work it out. Maybe I can figure a little some way to repel them. Have you heard about castor oil in repelling?
Yeah, no, it works. Absolutely, it works. Yeah.
How do you do that?
I've just bought the product. There's a product from Gardens Alive, and you put it out there. People also grow castor beans, you know. And supposedly the exudates also are repellent. There's also the gopher purge, which is not as toxic but has a similar repellent effect. You know? But I would bet that if you went online, somebody's going to have a recipe for just using straight castor oil.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I've heard of people doing that. I haven't done that. And my reason for not doing it is, it is very toxic, of course. You know, I mean, the famous one was, you know, a Bulgarian activist, you know, freedom activist, taken down during the Cold War by a prick from a sharpened umbrella tip that had a little bit of the poison from castor bean on it, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very, very poisonous. You know, you really do want to be careful if you have kids that are not trained well enough to not eat whatever they don't know, you know. I think that's a little overblown, the way they want to protect kids from every toxic plant. I mean, actually, throughout history, humans have been able to teach their kids to stay away from plants, and the kids have done fine, you know. I think we're really denying the intelligence and the ability to emulate and experience, you know, kinesthetically how to be safe. We're denying that aspect of kids. I think it's exaggerated, you know, how much people are, you know, insurance companies insist, you know, you can't have any poisonous plants at preschool or whatever. And, you know, kids can easily learn to stay away from that stuff. It's not hard. Now, I'm not saying not toddlers, actually, you know, not kids that don't have language skills yet, you know. But, you know, you could grow those, I think, and have kids around and be fine. But there are people who don't think that's true.
Right, they're so beautiful. They're such an ornamental plant, those castor bean plants.
They're incredibly ornamental.
Oh, they're gorgeous. Absolutely a work of art. And, you know, I've seen people, oh, are these edible? No. No, they're not edible. And I remember breathing in castor bean oil fuel from a motorcycle over at the Wheels Through Time Museum in Maggie Valley, a 100-year-old motorcycle burning castor bean oil. Wow. You know, it's a great fuel source. I guess you could make fuel with it as well.
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, it's like all plants, it has many aspects, and it is repellent because it is so toxic. But gopher purge, it's a, what's the family? The name of the family just slipped out, but it's a spurge, I think. Euphorbia. It's a lovely plant, and it has a similar effect. Not doesn't get huge at all. It's low to the ground. But, I know Richard McDonald has used that to keep the voles and stuff out of his garden, so I know that that also does work.
Okay. Yeah, I see it there, the Euphorbia letharis, gopher purge. They've got it at Mountain Valley Growers. They have some for sale out there that you can buy in different places. Gopher purge, it'll set seed and gives out a latex milky sap. Roots, yes, it's poinsettias are part of that family. Very interesting.
And it is also toxic, for sure. I mean, you wouldn't want anybody to eat it. But it's not as deadly, in my understanding, as castor bean. You know? So if you wanted to try something that wasn't quite as deadly, it's not as spectacular either. You're right, castor beans are a spectacular plant. But there's a higher impact if somebody was somehow misguided enough to ingest some of it. The gopher purge should accomplish the same thing for you.
Right.
So, and, of course, you know, my solution was Xena the Warrior Princess.
Oh, yeah, your little doggy, right?
She's now over the hill. You know, she doesn't really, you know, she'll do it a little bit, but it's only, you know, when she's feeling her youth again. You know, plenty of time she'd rather just curl up, you know, and she's got arthritis and her aches and pains. But she was actually very effective. You know, I probably said it on this show before. My whole strategy is terrierism, you know. You know, it's not about her killing every vole. Rather, I accept the damage that she would do. And she would do it like every season. There'd be one place of heartbreak. But I purposely got a miniature Jack Russell because of that. So the area of heartbreak was, she doesn't, you know, cover as much territory as a full-size Jack Russell. But that moment of heart for me was also a moment of utter terror for the voles. You know, they knew that there was this, you know, incredibly volicidal maniac out there who is obsessed and who obviously would go to incredible lengths, including ripping up large amounts of soil to get at them. And they just go away. It's like, hey, there's easier places to make a living, you know. And they tend to stay away for a whole season until he wasn't out there patrolling because there wasn't anything to patrol. And then they move back in again, and then the cycle would start again, you know. And I witnessed that at the Highland Lake Inn with their Russells. They had Rev and Liquor, both well-named traits of the Russells, you know. Rev is actually named after, you know, Jack Russell. It was a Reverend Jack Russell who developed them. And then Liquor, because they sure will lick you if you're holding them up. They love to lick. But, you know, that's how they controlled their pest. And indeed, when Rev went over the hill, they actually had a serious rodent outbreak until they realized that they needed another Jack Russell. They were not being particularly careful with many resources and didn't need to be, because the Jack Russell ensured that nothing might move in. And without the Jack Russell, boy, there was an explosion until, you know, they caught on it was time to get another Jack, and then boom, they had control again, you know. So that is another solution. You know, there's a bunch of breeds that are for that. The breed that interests me most, I've only read about it, but if I were in the market for a farm dog and was actually on the ground enough, like all day long, every day, that I could have a working dog with me, I'd go for an English Shepherd, because it supposedly has all the qualities of guard dogs, breeding dogs, and varmint dogs in one dog. The tale that I get about that dog, though, is that you do not want that dog if you are not going to be working, because it is incredibly intelligent and deeply motivated and bred to do that work, and without that, it is doomed to mischief and, you know, just not being able to use its energy. So, you know, the realm, you know, years ago, I tried to have a workshop on all the working dogs, but the person who had committed to doing the part wasn't able to make it. And that was through the grower school. But that's something we should look at for next year, is find enough experts on the various working dogs. There was just an interesting email through the CFSA listserv from John Bonnets about people who get guard dogs and then turn them into shelters, because guard dog can't be just put out in the field with the animals needing to be protected and to be expected to do its work. You know, they actually have to be trained. But if they're trained, they, of course, are incredibly successful at protecting animals from various predators. And you can use them for almost any animal, and they'll work out fine, but they do need to be trained. And that's the case with all these animals. We've bred them to do this work, but that breeding was always intended to be in concert with the humans, you know. And that's how guard dogs work. They were, you know, an extension of the shepherd, but the shepherd was out there. And now people just think they can, you know, buy a guard dog, put it in an enclosed area with their animals, and the guard dog is going to want to stay there and not be bored and try and play with the animals and then damage them somehow and stuff. And not have all the problems of an untrained dog, which genetics say use this energy. So you have to, you know, do some training. We had to train Zini, you know, what she could do and what she couldn't do. And we never could train her not to go off on wild rabbit chases. You know, we would oftentimes wish she was in the garden going after the voles when she would be running through the multiflora for hours on end trying to catch a rabbit. But she still managed to do enough control for us that we didn't have any rodent problems at all when she was in her prime. No sane rodent would stick around with that wild, you know, obsessed beast in search of them.
Well, I know now that when she's laying there in her golden years all curled up, that her little memories are going back to all those great rabbit chases and all those molons. You know, those little doggies, yeah. They've got to roll through their memories there.
Yep.
And
yeah.
I know she's got some good ones, because doggies love that. My dog loved going after little animals, too. Not domesticated ones, just the wild ones.
Yeah. No, that is Zena, too. She actually thought that she could go after chickens, too, and I still... The vision I always will be of a recovering hen who, you know, if you don't have roosters, various hens will take on every role of a rooster, including the guardian role. And this hen was one of those hens. And, you know, I would sometimes in at night, and there'd be these hens, like, doing the strutting and the challenging and raising the hackles like they were roosters, you know, because somebody had to do that job. And one of those hens was in the infirmary, as I called it, which means I would take it back to the house so it didn't have to be, you know, not well among the flock, because chickens are not kind to the unwell. And it's harder to heal if your entire flock is picking on you. So I had that chicken in the yard just roaming around, and Zini determined that she could, you know, chase it and have fun with it and maybe do more if, you know, and of course I had trained her not to do more, but she still was always inclined to do that, so she couldn't resist trying to chase this chicken one time, and the chicken did that rooster thing, and the chicken was actually, when it did that whole puff itself up and raise the tackles and stamp its leg, quite a lot more being than Zini, and she had no idea what it was, and she went from trying to chase the chicken to turning tail, tucking tail, and running in desperate fear from that chicken, and that's one of the funnier moments in my farming career, was watching my Jack Russell fleeing a hen, you know.
Oh, I had a super one. It's mind much of it. I had a cat, and I had a big guinea fowl that hung around the old cabin in Cherokee. And this big guinea fowl had been the old grandma's guinea. It was her last one, and that guinea owned that place. You know, she would come anywhere she pleased and come right up to the garden. She was very sweet, and I loved her. And my cat could not get over the idea of wanting to just go as close as she could to this giant bird, you know, and it was just so exciting. And so she started to pretend, I swear, this cat started to pretend she was a bird. And she started kind of pecking at the grass, kind of coming a little closer, a little bit closer, chewing on the grass and looking the other way, you know. Oh, as soon as the guinea looked at her, wait a minute, what are you doing coming over here pretending you're a bird? And so the cat, oh, she'd look away again, just enough coquettishness there. Oh, eats more grass, got a little closer, till she was literally rubbing sides with this guinea fowl, and the guinea fowl is looking at her like, you really think I believe that you're a bird? And she's side by side here, pecking at the grass, when finally the guinea said, this is game is up. And she stood up, looked at the kitty, and got those wings out, like you said, and went, wah, 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 like, what do you think you're doing? And that cat took off so fast. But she was like, I just have to get up close to this thing. You know, it was really hilarious watching the cat pretend she was a bird, as long as she could get away with it.
that is actually, it does happen. It's interesting how animals have way more flexibility of behavior than we could imagine.
I had no idea. My big one I just learned about, Pat, I just did a whole thing on it in the show here, was roly-polies. You know, the little pill bugs?
Mm-hmm.
I have just discovered a whole world of amazingness about them. They're, of course, not insects, right? They're crustaceans. They've got seven pairs of legs, and they even have a marsupium. They have a little pouch where their babies live underneath their tummy, and they do not urinate. They simply breathe through these gills, and they actually have a specially designed gut that can digest heavy metals. They can actually, that's why they can live in these contaminated areas. You know, in cities we find them everywhere. They actually can take in and ingest heavy metals and ionize them in their gut and turn them into this other material, and they really help with breaking down the soil and working with the plants. I was amazed.
Yeah, they definitely are incredible about working the soil. I mean, they're very important detritivores. They really, you know, part of why we're not buried in undecayed matter. You know, through the shredding, the important shredding, then allows the bacteria and the fungi to process it further, you know. And I didn't think about the heavy metals, though. That's very fascinating. So they don't chelate it. They somehow change their nature such that the heavy metals are bound in the soil. Is that what they do?
They have a, let me find this, because it was the most amazing little thing about roly-polies I've ever seen. And what they do is they have this section in their gut where they can take in the heavy metals, and they actually ionize them and turn them into this little sort of pellet that then moves to their mid-gut. And then from there, they metabolize them out, where by the time that they, you know, that they exude them in whatever form that they're doing, they poop them out or whatever they're doing, they're no longer the same ion of the heavy metal that damages our water and our soil. So it's their gut process. They've got this ionizing chamber, like the pre-gut ionizing sort of section. And I'll have to find that article again.
Yeah, if you find it, send me the link.
Yeah,
because
I clicked off it. Yeah, I get so many things going, I click off it. But
I'll
find that again. Yeah.
No, I knew about them being crustaceans, and I knew their important role in making sure that, you know, the proper shredding happens. They're definitely shredders. They're part of the processing of dead material, you know. And they can occasionally, you know, if we haven't mentioned it, if you do get the occasional outbreak of roly-polies, you know, feeding on your, our style bugs are also known as, feeding on your seedlings, the solution is a drench with lice. And I did that, and boom, they were gone. They never came back, you know. Very simple. It was in an old edition of organic, you know, Rodale's Organic and Gardening Encyclopedia. So that's something for people to know. And actually, when you're talking about them being marsupials, I wonder then.
Well, there's crustaceans, right? But they have a marsupium.
Right. That's
yeah,
what
they have a little pouchy in their on their underside there. I actually found the article now. What's that?
Are they then feeding in there too? Is the sow bug somehow excreting some kind of food that they can feed in, or they then come out of the marsupia to feed?
You know, they did not mention that detail, but I did find the article, and it describes how they take in heavy metals like lead, cadmium, and they actually crystallize the ions in their gut. The heavy metal toxins are then made into spherical deposits in the midgut. And that's how they process it. They crystallize it, and they form it into these little pellets.
And then what I'm wondering is, what happens? Are they remediators, or are they simply able to survive within this?
I think they're actually changing, because it's turning from the heavy metal ions, they're taking them, and they're actually crystallizing them.
So then they would not be readily available to other plants.
Right. That's, so they're actually cleaning.
That's what's dynamic about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a cleanup property. They're actually cleaning up contaminated sites.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. I was reminded in reading about that, because, of course, we think that only marsupia would have a marsupia. You know, I probably have mentioned in the past that I'm pretty fascinated with birds, too, and love not only bird guides, but also the books about bird behavior. And one of my favorites is the Birders Field Guide. Is that the name of it? Actually, let me look at it. I'm forgetting the name of it right this second, but I got it on a shelf, so it won't be hard for me to tell you the name. Because it's a book that anybody who's into... Oh, no, it's not here. It must be up in Sela. I'll have to come back with that. Anyways, Paul Ehrlich is one of the authors. I think it might be Birders Field Guide. But anyways, our handbook or something. It's a really wonderfully big, fat book about birds, which, you know, covers every bird, has a page which talks about, you know, what their nest looks like, how many eggs, all about their behaviors, whether they hawk, which is like kind of to, you know, stay in place, flapping their wings, and then like dart forward and grab an insect or a bird or whatever, all the different behaviors that birds do and all that. And then they have articles about birds, you know, like one side, on every page, the left side is about a specific bird and every attribute, what they eat, you know, if they're monogamous, all kinds of stuff like that. And then the other side is an essay. And one of the essays is about the fact that birds actually make milk.
Oh.
They, you know, like we make nut milk for people who don't want to drink cow's milk. Birds do that too. They'll get seeds and nuts and chew them up and mix them with, you know, various probably saliva and other, you know, secretions, and make a high protein liquid that they feed to their young. And that was pretty fascinating to me too. It's like nature has figured out, you know, what the best vehicle for various, you know, needs of life are, and one of the vehicles that is great is milk for feeding young. But only mammals manufacture milk as far as I know, I don't actually back
from
off.
Their
it's
body.
Probably an exception that'll prove that rule. By and large, mammals are the animals that actually make milk as part of the bodily process and actually secrete it. But birds actually still make it and deliver it to their young. So it makes me wonder, you know, is that sow bug also figuring out a way in that pouch to feed the young like the marsupials?
I found a hint for that here. It's talking about how their crustaceans more closely related and resembling crabs and shrimp than insects, and that they actually, like kangaroos, they're actually toting their eggs in there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So they're carrying their eggs, which perhaps there's some, you know, enzymatic process or something that's helping to nourish the eggs. I'm not sure, but I don't think that they're actually
the
babies yet. But I'd have to look more into this to check, because now you've got me wondering.
Right, yeah. No, that's the wonderful thing about nature is it is endlessly fascinating. There's so much we can learn. You know, I'd never be bored. You know, if there's a moment when I don't have something I have to do or something I have to research, all I got to do is pick up any book about nature, open it up to any page, and just sit there and wonder, you know.
Yeah, I love it that this little creature that is so common and so overlooked and just all over the place is such amazing soil regenerator, and you know, and how they roll up in a little circle, that they really are all about the circle of life and composting and great for gardens. So I just love it that somebody like that, that little creature so common and so overlooked, is just a little wonder in there with that crystallizing of heavy metals in the gut and really working that soil, and just is filled with so much new information we just are beginning to learn about. And it's just so neat how we can find all this new stuff about some little creature we've looked at forever. You know, that I've seen everywhere. Everywhere I've ever lived, you see those.
Yeah, well, they are everywhere, yeah. And certainly everywhere, you know. If they're not there, there's something wrong, you know. They're a part of that system, you know. Well, thank you for that insight.
Yeah.
About nature, you know, that'd be a really good gift, you know, an excellent gift. You know, think of an aspect of nature that you would like to share with someone. You know, I mean, a gift that I've enjoyed giving many times to people is a good field guide, a pair of binoculars, and a bird feeder. You know, and I've had many a person tell me years later how much pleasure they got from watching birds at their bird feeder, and some of them actually became, you know, bird watchers. Just because I offer them, you know, that window, in one of many, many windows that we can find into the wonders of nature and ways to connect. And so that's, you know, if you're kind of stuck about what can I give, you know, I really don't respect the American, you know, ethic of, I don't somehow feel inspiration with a gift. I just assume, you know, make something or make something and give that. You know, I don't want to buy something just to buy something. But you may, you know, suddenly realize that there's a part of nature that you have really learned to love. Really, you know, an aspect of nature that fascinates you and you get great joy from knowing about. And that you got to that through some wonderful book, you know. And that might be something that you could share and offer to friends and family. So, just a thought.
There's some great new books out there. You know, of course, we've got Vandana Shiva's new book, Connecting the Dots Between Industrial Agriculture and Climate Change, Soil, Not Oil. That's a big new one that's out. And they're having Soil, Not Oil International Conference and all of these things. So Soil, Not Oil Coalition, getting together to promote respect for soils worldwide. And certainly some great films out there as well. Last week we talked about the movie Sink with the chemical industry and what we've been subjecting ourselves to, all these unsafe carcinogenic chemicals. Also the movie Bought, talking about why there's so many toxins out there. So some great films to get informed with. And, of course, great books. Soil, Not Oil by Vandana Shiva being another nice new one that is out there.
Actually, as you talk about industrial agriculture and all that, I had a moment, like a light bulb moment, as I constantly am going over the whole food safety discussion and debate and struggle that we're in with the FDA and with corporate agriculture right now as an organic grower. And I realized a major mistake that we made in our approach to insisting that there be justice for small farmers. I mean, I just was rereading the latest information from the Farm Ranch Freedom Alliance, and they were saying that the FDA admits that to implement all the rules they require for small farms, and actually this small farm is going to be a small farm that grosses more than $500,000 a year. That's the cutoff we got, that farmers don't have to do this incredibly onerous stuff. But, and we've said this before on this show, $500,000 a year is not that much for somebody who's got large acreage. And large acreage can be as little as 60 acres. You know, if they're going to make a living from that much land, they could easily hit $500,000 a year via Modernization Act of 2010. And as I thought about that, you know, something that I said but never managed to get traction with was, you know, the fact that a standard of safety is put on food producers, farmers in particular, right, which says there can be no slack. Anything you do that might possibly be dangerous, you can't do, right? Since there is a tiny chance that manure could get somebody sick, you have to go through incredible lengths to use your manure, even though there's a, you know, thousands of years of humans using manure for fertility and we've thrived as a people incredibly, incredibly well, even though there might have been moments of sickness. And I pointed out that, you know, this standard is applied to food production, and yet when we look at the chemical world, you know, there are incredibly deadly chemicals that there's no doubt in anybody's mind cause cancer that are our modern world because they're convenient. You know, I still remember Elmo, who used to work with us here but was, you know, in training, an emergency room nurse, said when I mentioned that benzene is, like, there's no safe amount of benzene, it's a known carcinogen, and it can cause cancer with the least exposure. And he said, they actually use benzene to prepare arms, or prepare bodies for Band-Aids, for large Band-Aids, to be sure they heard well, they'll wipe down benzene. You know, and this is something that we know is a carcinogen, but because it's convenient, because it's an incredibly effective solvent, we've decided that the risk is worth it. You know, that there's enough benefit to society that some people die from the cancer caused by benzene, and yet there's no risk a lot for farmers, even though the future of the planet is enhanced by focusing on soil and making sure that all manure gets recycled. It's not allowed. So I didn't manage to get traction with that. You know, it just didn't really, nobody really picked up on the argument that I made. It just, you know, it didn't really take. And I realized that we have a strategy that instead of saying, okay, you need to look at, you know, the fact that you have a double standard, we should have insisted that there not be a double standard, and that, yes, if we're going to have a Food Safety and Modernization Act, then we need to also ensure that no chemical that is associated with food has any chance of causing illness or making people sick. That we no longer say there's a cost benefit. If there's no cost-benefit analysis applied to the organic, healthy soil practices that we use, then no cost-benefit analysis can be applied to the chemicals that we apply. That should have been one of our approaches. I guess it still can be in the future, but it seems to me that that's a strategy for organic and sustainable growers in the future. Is you want that standard, then it has to be applied across the board, not just to the possibility of microbial contamination, but also to the certainty of chemical contamination if you use the processes you use. And just because the effect is acute in one way and long, you know, over the long haul in the other way, does not at all deny the certainty that both have the potential to cause harm.
Well, we've certainly been made to be thinking we're supposed to be afraid of the things we really shouldn't be, and then have ignored the plethora of toxins spewing in our atmosphere that we produce, that somebody's making money on without calculating those hidden costs. It's pretty amazing. Have you heard about the methane leak going on in California and L.A. County, Pat?
No, I have not. Is it coming from a dump?
It is being described as like the BP spill of natural gas. It's a storage system in the San Aliso Canyon, and they've got 100,000 pounds of methane per hour coming out. It's the seventh week that this has been happening. They've already got 1,800 people in homes that are evacuated. They're being warned that if you can light up anything, the whole air could light up. We've undone years of methane leaks. This is the biggest methane leak in California's history, and California, Southern California Gas says, oh, we can't get it under control. It won't be under control for months. And so we basically got a spontaneous combustion situation possible in L.A. County on top of all kinds of other gases coming out. And it was really interesting to get a look at the chart showing all of the underground gas storage facilities around the country, and which were basically people sitting on top of bombs, of giant bombs of this stuff. And over there, I mean, there's a ton of lawsuits flowing in. And I mean, it's just a massive amount of methane just spewing nonstop now for over 7 weeks.
Well, and the tragedy of this has many layers. And, of course, the piece that I immediately went to, you talked about a massive methane leak. Methane is 26 times more effective as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Right.
So we already are looking at, you know, how do we get, you know, our culture to stop accepting, you know, the delaying tactics, you know, fossil fuel industry, and move on global warming and, you know, hit standards that must be hit. We have no choice but to do it. As we look at that, how do we get there? You know, that's really hard. You know, only the United States struggles as much with this as far as I know. But, you know, it's something we struggle with, and I accept I have to work on that. meanwhile, as I work on that and do whatever I can to try and ensure that we are using less fossil fuel, we have a leak like this, and it just makes it like that much harder, massively so.
Yeah, it's like we don't have an issue with climate destabilization. We don't have that problem. Oh, yeah, let's just spew this stuff. I mean, just to me, the fact that any company can build a thing that they have no ability to control
right.
when it malfunctions, that's just the definition of ecocidal industry. You know, you make the money from exploiting the earth and its resources, but then you have no way to manage it, and now we have vast amounts of hidden costs that everyone is paying for quality of life, you know, on Earth and in our climate by having this go on. It's like, okay, the hidden cost ignored. Meanwhile, we have no idea how we're going to control it. We've never seen one this bad. And they really have no idea how they're even going to get it under control. It's about a mile deep. It's got, you know, room for tons and tons of this methane down there, and it's spewing big time. But glad to see there's no underground storage facilities in North Carolina. We weren't even on the chart. I was kind of happy at least to see that. But I'm kind of concerned for the other people out there.
Yeah, and I'm going to be visiting my aunt in Seneca Falls, New York, and they had a big fight up there for, I forget what they wanted to store. I think it was gas, though. And there was a major activist movement against it. Major involvement from the sustainable food community. You know, they did a whole lot of dinners and banquets and farmers markets at the site, you know. And I have to check in and see where they got with that. But they were definitely getting the attention and saying, we don't want this, you know, in our neighborhood, and for these reasons, you know, and lots of times, you know, there's a dynamic there, you know, there's a push pull as, you know, as jobs are offered, you know, people, you know, we have an economy ravaged by the policies of neoliberalism, you know, unfettered global trade, of the ability of industries to move offshore and cut their costs, you know, at the expense of the environment and justice for workers and stuff, to the point where there aren't the manufacturing jobs in America. So jobs are always an issue. And people find themselves looking at industrial prison systems, looking at various, you know, systems that they don't really want, but then they need the jobs, you know. And so it's always a challenge there, you know. I understand it. I don't ever want to be saying it's simple for a community to say, no, we don't want to store gas in our salt caves or in whatever underground caverns they may have because they need the jobs. But then, you know, it's important that we also not forget this history, you know.
Yeah, the Aliso Canyon gas storage field is the biggest one that manages all the natural gas that's dispersed all over that whole part of California. And it looks like a volcano on infrared, but you can't see it with the naked eye. But
right.
You've basically got this volcano and all these people relocating, and their big problem is they can't bring in the equipment to work on it because it'll spark. And so they're completely looking at spontaneous combustion. They're bringing in the Kuwaiti oil field fire people. I mean, you know, they've got 100 workers on there that they're concerned about their health. It's just a big mess. Down in L.A. County, this methane gas threat going on out at Porter Ranch. So,
yeah, that's a scary thing. You know? On the other hand, small scale methane production could be one more piece to, you know, not doing fossil fuels.
Right.
You know, methane, you know, natural gas is methane, and yes, there's fossilized methane, but there's also methane made all the time, and we have all kinds of decay that we are inevitably going to have because we make agricultural waste. And sometimes the best thing to do with it is to concentrate that and capture that gas and use it for energy. And that's something that can be done on a small scale. The thing about scale is so important because if somebody's little backyard, you know, properly made, perfectly safe methane system somehow goes wrong because of human error, which we can count on, you know, if people, you know, don't believe human error is a factor in dangerous industries, let me mention Fukushima, let me mention Chernobyl. You know, Fukushima went down because of a tidal wave, but human error exacerbated that, and the error of putting it in a tidal wave zone, of course, was the original human error. And so we can count on human error, and small-scale methane could have human error at any time. This is probably worth the risk. There are cost-benefit analysis that humans have to make all the time. If we didn't take risk, we wouldn't be as successful as a species as we are. But in this situation, if the small methane producer fails methane, pretty inconsequential. I mean, maybe not as consequential for that person. There could be a tragedy there for them. But as far as the impact on the world, not really that big. That small-scale diversified use of methane for energy totally makes sense for all of us humans that want to have our warm houses, be able to cook, you know, be able to do the things that methane gas, our natural gas, does. That makes sense. Centralize it and store it in great amounts, then you are looking at, you know, the natural gas version of Chernobyl or Fukushima, and it sounds like we got it right now. So just once again, getting that human scale and natural scale is a scale that we as a species are incredibly well adapted to manage. When we get to the industrial scale, we're newbies. We're total newbies. We really don't know what we're doing. There's a lot of hubris. There's great drive for profit, but the consequences can be very great.
And, you know, I think it's the same in gardening, right? The vast monocropping, big-scale stuff doesn't really work for our environment. But then if we do it small scale and we keep it local and we share it and we get more gardens growing everywhere, we could be sequestering more carbon, feeding more people, and even having more fun. Well,
I think you're right. Yeah, and that should be the final words. I mean, the model applies everywhere, folks. Guy Shoemaker, wasn't he? Small is beautiful.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, it's true. I mean, that is the nature that we are wonderfully adapted as a species to thrive at, you know. And so, you know, this is a great time to think about that, because what are we all going to be doing, like, over the holidays, no matter what our, you know, this season, you know, solstice is celebrated in almost all, probably all cultures. So it's a time of celebration. The light is returning, you know, whatever your religion. This is a moment of celebration, and it can be a sacred time too, and I deeply respect that and share the sense of the sacred with this time of year. But how do we really experience that? How is it really important to us? It is on the small community scale. You know, that is the scale where the meaning is deep and the power of this time is so incredible. You know, whether that's in a church at a midnight mass or at a home on Christmas Eve or on Christmas morning with kids opening packages, or at a Hanukkah celebration, you know, candles being lit, whatever it is that small community-based celebration that is so powerful. And I hope everybody has a wonderful celebration this year. I'm sure it'll be more powerful and more wonderful if you remember that your connection to nature is ultimately a driver for all of this. It is solstice that inspires all of this celebration this time of year, and I hope that you keep that also in your heart and remember that it is the natural world that nourishes us, and it's a natural world that we must protect.
And certainly a thing we're doing, and keeping those small things in perspective, right? Each little thing counting. Well, we're heading to the very last bit of this 2015. It's been great. We've got one more show for the year coming up next week as we get ready for a brand new 2016. Looking forward to more growing in many different ways, both in the garden and personally, as well as in our community. There with you, Pat, and hope you have a wonderful Christmas.
I hope you have one too, and I hope everybody has an absolutely wonderful and joyous holiday, and we'll talk next week. Okay.
Okay. Have a wonderful week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. That is Patrick Battle, This Week in the Garden, as we get into celebrating this wonderful season. And it's always a joy to do that here on the show and to discuss gardening and all the ways that these issues come together. It's always up to us, though, to make those healthier choices, to reach out in love, and to celebrate life together in diversity. Enjoy your Christmas week and your solstice week and your Kwanzaa week and your Hanukkah week over and every other culture out there. Wishing you many blessings and much bliss as we wrap up 2015. We'll have one more show this year as we talk to you next week right here on Earth Heart Network Radio.